Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.
At New Life, we often say, Jesus might live in your heart, but Grandpa lives in your bones. That we have been shaped by our families of origin and our larger cultures to see others in particular ways. It's amazing to see the conversations that happen in person. Black Lives Matter, for example, I remember saying that and clarifying, saying, when I say that, I'm talking about that in the theological category, not organizationally, not sociologically. And yet still, people could not separate a phrase like that from a particular organization.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian magazine. And you can get yourself a subscription special offer right now at premierchristianity.com. Here on The Profile, we like to sit down with a different Christian each and every week to hear something of their story. And I'm really pleased to say that my guest on the show is the New York City-based pastor, Rich Velodis. He is the leader of New Life Fellowship, which is a large multiracial church. He's also a key speaker for emotionally healthy discipleship and the author of a number of books, most recently, The Narrow Path. He enjoys reading widely and preaching and writing on contemplative spirituality, justice-themed issues, and the art of preaching. Rich, welcome to the show.
Sam, what a delight. Thank you for the kind invitation.
It's great to have you on. I mentioned that you enjoy reading widely. So tell me, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, I just finished a wonderful book by Marilynne Robinson. It's a classic of hers called Gilead, a story about a pastor in Iowa in the United States, aging pastor writing essentially letters to his son, and was really captivated by the storytelling and theology around that, and picked up so good. I picked up her most recent book on reading Genesis, which I'm about 100 pages in. So that's what's currently
amazing.
Reading these days.
Well, that's so interesting you mentioned that, because Marilynne was a guest on this show just a couple of months ago. And right. So we got to talk plenty about Gilead and indeed reading Genesis, which sounded fascinating when I got to spend some time with her. Is it hard to find the time to read as a busy pastor? Is that something you have to sort of deliberately safeguard time around to do the work?
You know, thankfully, I mean, reading has been somehow I graduated high school. Because I did not read whatsoever during that time as a teenager. When I came to faith in Christ as a 19-year-old, somehow I got this insatiable desire to read. So I made space for it. But then I had the privilege of joining a church, the church that I currently pastor, when I joined as an associate pastor. And the culture there was essentially that you get paid to, of course, pastor people, but you also get paid to pray and to read, and that we want our life to emerge from a deeper center, and often reading good books helps towards that. So I'm grateful to be part of a church culture that has normalized and in many ways prioritized the practice of reading. So I try to make time every day, and a few hours every week.
I know you're really interested in contemplative spirituality and what are sometimes called spiritual disciplines or practices. I've sometimes heard people refer to reading a book, as a spiritual discipline. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, spiritual discipline, I think, can be framed in that way, insofar that it's directing your heart, your mind to God. I don't think just any old book, kind of becomes a spiritual discipline matter. I think to what degree is it stirring your attention and affections towards God? And that does not have to be an overtly spiritual book. I think there are many times that I've read memoirs or biographies of people that, because of the content, something it made me glance upward towards God. And in that respect, that reading became a spiritual discipline. But generally speaking, many of the books that I read are an act of spiritual discipline, because it's cultivating attentiveness to God.
Well, we're going to talk about your latest book, The Narrow Path, in a moment. But before we get there, we like to go back to the beginning here on the show and hear about a person's early life growing up. So I believe you're born and raised in New York. But tell me a bit about early life and also where the Christian faith first came in the picture for you.
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Brooklyn, New York, one of the five boroughs of New York City. To give you a sense of the scope of Brooklyn, if Brooklyn was an independent city in the United States, it would be the third most populated city in the country. So 2.3 million people just in Brooklyn. So that's where I was born. I my parents were not Christian followers of Jesus. But when I was 5 or 6, they would send me to church with my grandparents, who lived down the block from me, a very small Pentecostal church. And so my earliest conceptions of God was in that context of kind of a holiness Pentecostal, very expressive version of Christian faith. And so from 5 to 12, I would attend this church, not always weekly, but definitely every month I was at this church, and sometimes multiple times a week. And by the time I was 12, I asked my parents if I could stop going to church. They said, yes, you don't have to go anymore. And then as a 17-year-old, some 5 years later, I found myself attending church again because I started dating a pastor's daughter. And the pastor said, the only way you can date my daughter is if you come to church. And so I said, I'll be there, sir. I'll be there multiple services. And it was there where I started getting a little bit more understanding of Jesus and what the Christian life was. The relationship came to an end when I was 19, a couple of years later. And I remember just so being so depressed, walking home one day from Queens, New York to Brooklyn, a good hour and a half walk. And when I got home, my parents were home, but my four younger siblings were at that small church that I used to attend with my grandparents. They were invited. There was an evangelist that was speaking there. And so I decided to go, maybe hoping someone would pray for me. And I arrived at this church. They're having a revival service. So there was typically 20 to 30 people that would attend this church. There was probably about 90 to 100 people cramped in this place. And about 15 minutes after I walk in, my parents walk in. And I didn't invite them, and they never went to church. And my father would say that he really sensed something deep in his heart, just say, follow him. And so he just followed me into the church. This preacher got up, preached on the book of Ezekiel 37 about a valley of dry bones, and said, God wants to breathe life into families and individuals. Who wants the breath of God? And about 15 family members came to faith in Jesus that night, August evening, 1999. And that got it was at that point where my heart was really captivated by God. From that point on, I had one of the most, I think what could be regarded as unusual first 8 months in the Christian journey, because my grandfather, who was very ill at the time, lived half a block down from me. He was just a holy man of God, as well as a brilliant man of God. And so he knew theology, he knew the scriptures. And so I remember walking down the street saying, Grandpa, I have a lot of questions about what just happened this past Sunday. Can I ask you a couple of questions? And he asked me to sit down next to him, shoulder to shoulder at the side of his bed. And about 2 hours later, we were done with our session. And then he said, why don't you come back tomorrow with some more questions? And for 8 months, we did that 4 to 5 days a week, 2 to 3 hours each time before he passed away. And so that was my entry into the spiritual life, following Jesus, being mentored for 8 months by my grandfather. And then from that point on, went to college and seminary, and then started working in local churches.
Amazing. How important was it to have those moments with your grandfather where one imagines sort of no question was off limits? You know, I was speaking to someone just recently, and part of their faith story, they're not a Christian, but part of their issue with the church was they were told one thing, and even in Sunday school, when they tried to question it or ask questions, they were shut down. And how important was it for you just to have that forum where actually you can ask questions and it's not seen as a threat?
It was remarkable. He was my grandfather. I mean, the word that I could use is he was hospitable. And I think hospitality is not just welcoming someone's presence. I think it's also welcoming their questions, their ideas, as wild as they may be from time to time. And because, I mean, I would attend church from 5 to 12, and I knew, a couple of Bible stories. But by and large, I had a lot of questions. And so I didn't even know what would be regarded as an inappropriate question to ask. I was just, here's what I'm thinking. Is this right? And he was just so patient with me. So I didn't have, thankfully, any, I wasn't self-conscious around the questions I was asking. But I think my grandfather just created a space where ask whatever you need in this moment, and I'll give you the best response that I can. And I think that's why we lasted 2 to 3 hours each time, multiple days a week, because the questions just kept coming.
If I'd asked you as a teenager before you'd come to Christ or come back to Christ, what do you want to do when you grow up? What would have been your answer?
Well, I think about my mother had a, there was this little booklet from the time I was in kindergarten. Do you go by kindergarten in the UK? I can't recall.
Nursery, yeah.
Yeah, nursery. So all the way through graduating high school. So from the time I'm 5 to 17, 18,
okay.
She had a little book that I would have to fill out every year, even through my teenage years, my name, my height, my weight. What do I want to be when I grow up? I put down, it ranged from a professional wrestler, like kind of like the Hulk Hogan kind of a thing there, like that kind of wrestler, not like wrestling in high schools, like for entertainment purposes. I wanted to be a baseball player. I wanted to be then a basketball player. A lawyer showed up in there at one point, but nothing of any sort of religious or spiritual kind of vocation. That was not within my mind at all. I wasn't thinking about anything along those lines. So to be in the place I'm at right now is not what I expected, even as late as my 17, 18 years of age.
And was coming to faith sort of separate to the call to be a pastor? Did you come to faith then a bit later on think pastor? Or did it all happen at once? You come to faith, you think, I'm going to be a pastor?
Well, it happened very rapidly because now you have to understand, I became a Christian within a Pentecostal tradition. And within that Pentecostal tradition, these small churches make space for prophetic words, promptings from the Spirit that the preacher feels compelled to share with individuals. And so within the first 6 months, I had a deep sense that I was called to preach, not necessarily pastor. Now, the backstory is I used to be a rapper as a child. My father was a DJ, and my father still is a DJ. He has like an internet radio show that he plays various kinds of music. So I grew up loving music, but also performing before people. And even as a teenager. And so I wondered if God was going to take that passion and kind of apply it to preaching. And so the first 6 months, there were about six different preachers that would either visit our church or our little youth group would go to another church. And they would say to me, young man, you in the black shirt or red shirt or white shirt talking about me. And they would say very something similar, like God has called you to preach his word. And so I did sense that I was called to be a preacher. And my first pastor, he was in his maybe mid upper 60s when I became a Christian. He had a stroke and started asking me to preach for him by my 7th month being a Christian, because I was just so zealous and I was at every church meeting, the women's meeting, the men's meeting, the young adults meeting, I was everywhere. And so he would send me to preach at these churches that had 10 people, 15 people. And so it started there. And then I learned, I did not know that Christian colleges and universities existed. And so I heard about one studied theology and then realized, oh, I think God wants me to preach, but in a pastoral vocational context. And so that began to unfold within the first, I think, 2 to 3 years after saying yes to Jesus.
Who are the preachers who have most shaped you?
My mind initially goes to my family members. My grandmother Carmen was a preacher. My grandfather Marcus, her husband, was a preacher as well. My aunt Minerva was one of the more passionate preachers and expositors of the faith. So just that's from a family perspective. There is a guy by the name of Gabriel Salguero who is really regarded as a mentor, a big brother to me. He's a pastor in Orlando, Florida. I saw him. He came to preach in my church when I was 20. He was about 25, 26. And I said, that's what I want to do. I just saw his command of the scriptures and his command of the content and his passion. And then if you want to start talking about the larger groups of people who have influenced me over the years, I mean, anyone from the Martin Luther King Jr. to the Ron Rollheiser, who's a Canadian Catholic priest, who I love his sermons and homilies, to some really probably not real well-known Pentecostal preachers. So I could jog my memory here, but those are the initial faces and names that come to mind for me.
And your latest book is perhaps about the most famous sermon ever preached. You've called the Sermon on the Mount the best TED talk ever given. It certainly stood the test of time, hasn't it? 2,000 years on, we're still talking about it. So, what are you hoping Christians will take away from your unpacking and your thoughts on this ancient sermon? I don't know. Is it daunting as a writer? You think, all these amazing people have written thousands of words on the Sermon on the Mount, and now I'm giving it a go. What are you hoping to bring to the kind of the discussion around this most famous of sermons?
Yeah, well, to that point, I did feel very, in many respects, insecure about it. Like Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Dallas Willard and tons of commentators that have done incredible work. I would hope, number one, that people would take Jesus's words seriously, that his words and his kingdom really lead to the spacious kind of life that we long for. That in many respects, the narrow path, it comes across as narrow and restrictive. And in many ways it is, because it's restrictive to our false self. It's restrictive to the kind of the world dominated influence that we tend to be motivated by. It can feel very constraining in that way. But more than anything, I want people to take Jesus seriously at his word, that his teachings actually lead to the kind of spacious life we really long for.
You boil this down into sort of six practices, get really practical in the book. So meditating on Jesus' teachings, hunger and thirst for righteousness, speaking truthfully, praying for enemies, silent generosity, surrender anxiety. These are some of the things you kind of pull out. Which of those do you personally find the easiest, and which one do you find the hardest?
Oh, the easiest. I'm not sure if there's an easiest to it.
I guess that's the point of the narrow path, that it's narrow, so none of it's easy.
Yeah. I mean, if we're going to talk, it might be 1A, 1B, 1C in terms of difficulty here. I mean, my mind, in terms of, let me start with difficult first. I mean, my mind immediately goes to enemies. I have a hard time, Sam, liking people who just disagree with me on social media, let alone someone who is actively against me and seeking my demise. That's a whole nother category of enemy. And so when I think about Jesus's words, I go, Lord, who can do any of this? I feel like his disciples, like with humans, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. So I think the enemy piece here is one that might be most difficult. And then, Sam, if I'm honest, like I could go, no. It's the judgment piece. It's my ability to judge people very swiftly and come to all kinds of final conclusions about their lives based on one or two things that I've observed. And then I go, no. Actually, it's the money one. The money, like money. I grew up very poor, and so money has always been enticing. And so it continues to be so. Money is not just this neutral tool. It's a rival god that's trying to pull me into its orbit. I'm not sure if there's anything that comes, even prayer. I mean, I've written many books about prayer, and I find that prayer is one of the most difficult things for me to do consistently and with a joyful spirit. I'm usually dragging myself to pray. You know, I just wish I could wake up in the morning and go, you know what? I have all the energy in the world to give my attention to God, and I'm just going to do it right now and feel really good about it. Usually, that's not how I'm approaching prayer. I'm approaching prayer with, it's like, you know, oh, here we go again. And am I going to fall? This is going to be boring. And is God going to meet me? And so I think that is the point of the narrow path, that I'm not sure any of it comes easily. It is very demanding. And in many respects, this was Dietrich Bonhoeffer gets at with the Sermon on the Mount. When Christ calls a person, he bids them to come and die. I think every facet of the narrow path is an invitation to die. And everything within us rages against that. And so I would classify all of the teachings within the difficult category.
And people have understood this in different ways. I mean, one understanding I've heard people say is these teachings of Jesus are so difficult that they are actually unattainable. And they're almost sort of given for this reason, for us to realize that you can never match this standard that Jesus is setting down. And it should lead you to a place of repentance and, God, I'm sorry, and I can't live up to it. I mean, this is how some people have sort of preached or understood the Sermon on the Mount. And I think sometimes that almost minimizes the kind of the calling on us as Christians to try and follow this stuff, because we're just told, oh, well, you can't do it. So just sort of give up and don't worry, God will forgive you. I think you're coming from quite a different perspective, but do you want to respond to that kind of interpretation and what you think of it?
Yeah, 100%. I think in many traditions, the prevailing interpretation around the Sermon on the Mount is idealism. It's idealistic. And the Sermon on the Mount was given so that we could name our inability to live it and trust in the grace of God. And I think Jesus does not place the accent on that. I think Jesus places the accent on and the emphasis not simply on trusting in God for our inability to live it out. I think I would reverse that. I think Jesus calls us to trust in God so that through the resources of God, we're able to live this out. Certainly not perfectly. Certainly not without flaw. The challenge I have with those who say, oh, you can't live this trust in God, it almost gives you a very easy way out to not love enemies, to not deal with our anger, to not deal with our lust, to not deal with the ways that our yes and no vacillates. I think Jesus places the accent on the living, on the working it out. That need not go down the road of kind of performative spirituality or works righteousness or trying to earn your salvation kind of language. I think the New Testament scholar Dale Bruner, one of my favorite insights from him on the Sermon on the Mount is that before Jesus commands, he blesses. And the Beatitudes come before the commands as a way of saying God's blessing, God's favor, God's grace rests on us before he asks us to do anything. And so there's no kind of earning your salvation here. It's the free work of grace. And I think the accent of the Sermon on the Mount is on the living, not simply on just the believing in God.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate? Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
Do you have any inspiring stories, either in your own life or other Christians, where you've seen these values lived out by Christians and it's inspired you and you think, yeah, this, as you say, this stuff, it is possible. We can live this way as Christians.
A couple of thoughts come to mind. The first is, I think about in our congregation, the ways that we have thought about anger. Jesus you know, the Sermon on the Mount, the language Jesus uses is he is referring to the Ten Commandments. You have heard it said, you shall not murder. That's commandment number six. But I tell you that if you are harboring anger against someone, you are already down a really bad road. And so we have spent a lot of many hours in our congregation helping people to address the deep-seated anger that lives within us, the resentments, the ways that we keep anger alive and nurture it over the course of our lives. We have in our congregation offered language of lament to help us get beneath the surface of our anger. I think that's what ultimately Jesus is doing in the Sermon on the Mount as well. He's not in that day, not murdering was like the standard. And it's kind of a low standard, Sam. It's just like, I didn't murder anyone today. I'm doing really good as a Christian. It's just like, I don't know if that's really the standard that we should be living up to here. And Jesus, I think, kind of senses that, like, you set the bar so low for yourself. But those of you who have not physically murdered anyone are carrying deep resentments and anger and rage against certain people. And we live kind of in this world where there's interior anger and cultural anger that so manifests itself in our society. So I think in my own life and in our congregation, we've worked really hard to take Jesus's words seriously there, to tend to our anger so as not to contribute to the angry society. And I'm not talking about anger from a sense of here's an act of injustice that we're really angry about. I'm talking about that anger that is nurtured, that is really not about addressing wrongs. It's just hatred. And I think that's kind of the anger that we're addressing. And that's what we've seen in our context.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about your context in New York City. You're someone who, as you say, you grew up there, ministered there, know the place incredibly well. And you've also traveled. So I know last summer you were here in the UK. So, you know, you've experienced other cultures as well. What is it about a place like New York City that's distinct? What are the highs and the lows of doing ministry where you are?
I think about two things immediately. One is just the unrelenting pace of life, which in many respects, I think we have exported our New York illness.
A city that never sleeps.
City that never sleeps. We've got that name for a reason. And so the pace of life is so unrelenting. I preached at a church recently in Times Square. I was walking in Times Square and I just found myself walking at a pace. I was early. I didn't need to rush. I could have taken a leisurely stroll. And I found myself just walking so fast. And I realized I'm just being absorbed in this pace of this culture. So I just think that the fast pace of life, and when I talk about fast pace of life, I'm not just talking about people walking fast down the street. I'm also talking about the level of pressure we have to perform, the unrelenting nature of getting business done here. So our lives are incredibly full. I think so much of the pace of life emerges because what we're carrying in life, there's just so much to manage that if we don't go from one thing to the next, we're not going to survive. So ministering in a context, you know, even recently, I've been asking people within our own community to say yes to a few spiritual formation programs that we have. And a number of people have said to me, I just can't carry it right now. I can't say yes to this invitation because of all I have going on. And it just reminded me, I thought, so tell me, when are you going to have the margin to actually do this? Because chances are, because of the unrelenting nature of our life and our city and the culture around us, we'll never make time for this. So that's number one. I just say the pace of life. Number two, ministry in this city, especially in my context, Sam, because I'm in Queens, New York. Again, if Queens was an independent borough, it'd be the fourth largest city in our country right after Brooklyn. And so we're talking about a lot of people, millions of people, but Queens is the most international of the boroughs. And so within our congregation, we have over 75 nations represented in our church. in a neighborhood where 123 languages are spoken. And that's just the ethnic cultural diversity. There's also socioeconomic diversity, generational diversity, political diversity. And so in my context, in my part of the city, of course, this is reflected in the larger city and in our country, but the level of diversity is a beautiful gift, and it makes it extremely difficult to navigate the realities of our world. In my church every Sunday, there are people all over the social and political spectrum whenever I talk about whatever issue. And that just makes it very difficult. Those contexts also make it very difficult for churches to grow consistently. You know, there's some churches that, because of their homogeneity of the church, they're able to attract the same kind of people that kind of look the same, think the same. In many respects, they grow very rapidly in some cases. To have a church that's marked by immense diversity is not a recipe for church growth.
Yeah, that sounds incredibly challenging to be ministering in a place where there is so much diversity economically, politically. If you don't mind me just going straight to the hub of the issue, the question that comes to mind is, there's an election coming this November. We all know American politics is incredibly divisive. The easy option, of course, would be to just to not touch it and not go there. But I also understand that you're someone who cares about issues of justice. Is there a real dilemma there? If you feel like politically, I think I have a moral responsibility as a church leader to teach into something, but politically, I know this is going to cause issues. How do you navigate that?
But in 2020, I actually, before the election, I did a 5-week series on God, politics, and the church. I began every message with these words. I said, if you vote for Donald Trump, you're welcome in our church. If you vote for Joe Biden, you're welcome to our church. I would hope that, number one, you would see your politics through Jesus and the kingdom of God, specifically the Sermon on the Mount, and not see Jesus through the lens of your politics. That secondly, you would live curious as to why those in our community might see the world different than you do. And then lastly, that we would live humble and prayerful lives as we seek to engage matters, and more importantly, how we engage one another. And so I began there. And then from that point on, my hope was to preach on allowing theology and allowing Jesus's words to shape kind of the moral direction, which I know is fraught with still lots of complexity, because how do we apply this aspect of Jesus's teachings to the very real issue of fill in the blank? And so my task, I think, first and foremost, was to lead our community in relating to one another differently. And in the same way this year, that's my hope. My hope is that I could pastor our congregation in that way. But Sam, I think one of the things that we've worked on over the years at New Life is creating a kind of discipleship and spiritual formation environment where we are able to remain emotionally connected to one another while having differing views on particular matters. And I think that's, you know, if I can borrow from family systems theory, this is the language of differentiation, where we're able to remain close to ourselves and close to another person, especially in times of high anxiety. And so we have worked hard over a number of years to build a theology and a spiritual formation environment where that becomes more possible. Doesn't mean everyone is opting into that. Doesn't mean everyone is ordering their lives around that. But it does mean that from a cultural perspective in our local church, that this is what is normalized and prioritized. I do see it as a very urgent pastoral, moral task before me to help people navigate the political space really well, or as best as we possibly can.
You said it had been painful, though. What's been painful about it?
Well, what's painful is no matter what I say, someone's not going to like it. I want people to like me. I want people to, I don't like getting long emails. I don't like people saying, you know what? Have you thought about it from here? Or you're wrong because of XYZ. I don't know of any pastor who really enjoys receiving emails like that. If they do, I'd love to interview them and ask questions. But it's painful because I think part of it is the social media space. But even beyond that, people just see the world very differently. And I rather have harmony, everyone agreeing, everyone's polite, everyone's kind. Every email I get is, Pastor, this is a struggle I'm going through. Can you help me and pray for me? Or, hey, Pastor, here's a word of encouragement. I like those emails more so than I heard what you said and I don't like it. And this is why I disagree. It's just like, did you have to send that one? So that's number one. But secondly, I think painful in that in 2016, I did not have the pastoral pulse of my congregation as well as I thought I did in terms of how they see the world socially and politically. And I think because of some of the things I said or wrote, I think I alienated some people and hurt some people. And so my own sense of regret and grief around that has been painful. And I think God's helped me along those lines. And I think I've tried to change course, direction. But lots of those conversations, whenever I would talk about politics, usually leads to people leaving the church. It also leads to people coming into the church because they go, oh, you believe that? I'm coming here now. And so there's this, musical chairs kind of a deal that goes on in churches across this country. But it's painful in that I'm a pastor. I want to shepherd people and hold people together. And when folks decide to leave, that can be pretty disheartening.
Yeah. So political diversity can be tricky to deal with. You mentioned another one, which is racial diversity, and you said how was it over 70 nations' backgrounds represented in your church, which is incredible. And I know something that a lot of pastors in this country would long to see, actually, and hold theological convictions around. We do want to bring every tribe and nation and tongue together and have that sense of unity as we worship. But of course, must be fraught with problems. I think it was Martin Luther King who said 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning is the most segregated place in America. And we've had some similar issues in the UK, in that it's pretty normal to have a thriving black majority church in one part of the town and a thriving white majority church down the road. And perhaps the two don't ever really talk. So I'd love to hear any wisdom you have, any experience you have on, again, the challenges of building a multiracial church. What you've had to do as a pastor, what you've had to learn to create an environment where that's possible, and hurdles that you've had to overcome in doing that.
Well, first and foremost, I think the hurdle is around our understanding of what the gospel is. I think framing this topic through the lens of the gospel is probably the most important pastoral task for anyone who's trying to build communities where this is reflected. I believe that the gospel is the good news that the kingdom of God has come near in Jesus, and that in his life, death, resurrection, and enthronement, the powers of sin and death no longer have the last word, and that the primary fruit of the gospel is a new humanity, a new family, a new community is being established in Jesus. Now, this has everything to do with how local churches are ordered and organized. So I do think having a more of a robust understanding of the gospel, that of course it's forgiveness of sins, and of course is life after death, and of course it's that we are rescued by grace through faith. I think all of those things are things that we I hold true and exalt. And I think in this particular area, the fruit of the gospel is not simply an individual transaction. The fruit of the gospel is not simply forgiveness of an individual's sins. The fruit of the gospel is now we have a forgiven and forgiving community. The fruit of the gospel is now we have a renewed and renewing community, not just an individual. I think the accent on scripture is not on the individual, it's on the community. And starting there, I think, is really important. Otherwise, people go, oh, this is a social program, or this is a social gospel you're doing. No. This is actually the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the fruit of it is a new community, new humanity, new family. And then very practically, I think we've worked hard over the years, very practically, to try to reflect this value. Now, let me just say it flat out. We happen to be in a place where, because of the demographics of our community, lend more easily to being diverse. And so I take that as a given in some respects. At the same time, there are plenty of churches within my community that are not diverse to the extent that it should be because of who's in the neighborhood. And so I don't think pastors need to carry significant guilt around we're not diverse. Well, there's no one in the neighborhood that looks different. And so work with what you have here. But when that is possible and diversity is possible, I think, how is that reflected at the highest levels of power within a community, the decision making? Whose stories are being highlighted? What are we praying for on Sunday morning? Who's giving testimony? Whose stories is space being given to? You know, are there people on the staff or people who are leaders that reflect the makeup of the congregation? I think those are a few of the questions that we've worked really hard on addressing over these years. So much so that we intentionally say, we want whoever's on the stage, or if we have a gathering, whoever's speaking, we want it to reflect the people in the room. And so, you know, representation is important. But I think it starts with having a theology of the gospel, not just as a private kind of soteriological transaction, but the good news that God is creating a new humanity.
Why do you think, though, it continues to be such a fraught and difficult issue, both in the church and in culture? I mean, even just a phrase, if I were to use the phrase Black Lives Matter, like even that phrase in itself has become a divisive phrase.
So much of the ways we see the world is formed by our own families and cultures of origin. So at New Life, we often say this, we have this quip that says, Jesus might live in your heart, but grandpa lives in your bones. That we have been shaped by our families of origin and our larger cultures to see others in particular ways. And that stuff lives deep inside of us. What the challenge about this as well is, I think social media has a way of inflaming the inflammatory nature of social media makes it very difficult to have honest conversations, which is why it's amazing to see the conversations that happen in person rather than on social. There are really no conversations happening on social media, but because our lives are increasingly shaped by that particular medium, it spills out into how we see the world. There's no room for nuance. Like for Black Lives Matter, for example, I remember saying that and clarifying, saying, when I say that, I'm talking about that and as a theological, in the theological category, not organizationally, not sociologically, not a particular group of people. And yet still people could not separate in their own minds a phrase like that from a particular organization. And I think that's what makes it very difficult. But as a pastor, I think my biggest task, and this is where people like Stanley Hauerwas or people within a particular, maybe Anabaptist tradition, which I find myself having lots of alignment with, like my primary task is for the church to be the church. How can we model a different way of being in the world? It's very easy to want to go to address the way that culture is, ordered in our society. And I think there is certainly a place for that. But my primary task as a pastor is to have our community bear witness to that God is up to something within this community here, this local group of people, whether we're talking about 100 people, 1,000 people, or 10,000 people. That's the primary work that I have to do. And I think that that requires a level of integration. I'll just say, whenever I talk about racial justice and reconciliation, Sam, my conviction is that we need to talk about it on six levels. In order to have a responsible conversation around that. And for me, those six levels are, we have to talk about it theologically, historically, sociologically, politically, ecclesiologically, and formationally. I think those six areas, and when I talk about politically, I'm talking more so around how policy, the kind of policies that we create in the public, not so much who are you voting for. Which political party do you subscribe to? So for me, when I think about making any kind of inroads into this, I think we need those six areas in the local church in order to have a robust, comprehensive conversation around this.
Yeah, it's so interesting what you say about your calling for the church to be the church and to do that discipleship, and how it is kind of more tempting, and people think it's a bit easier, isn't it, to just stand and have a go at culture and shout at the cultural problems, and perhaps a bit harder for us to do the work on ourselves as the church and kind of get our own house in order first. But I guess that is part of your calling to help us do that.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you what, it's a lot easier to go on social media and share a few things and get a few likes and a few retweets and feel good about yourself and go, I'm doing good ministry here. No, the good ministry is the people that God has entrusted, I'm talking to pastors in particular, the people who God has entrusted to you under your care. To what degree are you leading those people to do the interior work that will help them see the world differently and see the gospel differently?
Challenging thoughts. Rich Philotas, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for joining us on The Profile.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Since 2016, the Premier Gospel Awards has celebrated the heart and soul of gospel music. Now, in 2024, powered by Compassion UK and live from London's iconic Royal Festival Hall, we're bringing you our biggest and best show yet. Join us on Saturday, September 21st, for an unforgettable night of special guests and live performances from the biggest names in the UK, USA, Africa, and more. Last year's event sold out fast, so don't wait to grab your ticket. Buy now at premiergospelawards.org.uk. The biggest ever Premier Gospel Awards. It's the culture. It's the message. It's the music.